This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
It's 9 o'clock, so we'll call a meeting to order. The first activity is the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the United States of America, to the Republic which stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Hold the call button to cancel. Call detected. Hold the call button to cancel. Call detection canceled.
We have a roll call.
Yes.
Let's see who's here and who's on the line.
Sure. I did just resend Bob Colby the link, but we'll keep that.
What's that?
I did just send Bob Colby the link, so hopefully he joins. Tom Hurlbert.
Excuse.
Yep. John Fowler.
Here.
Michelle Dennis.
Here.
David Gretler. Bob Colby. John Lauk.
Here.
Bill Pearson.
Here.
David Patterson.
Here.
Laura Rohde.
Here.
Ryan Sandvig.
Here. Good morning.
Swiper. Here. So we have a quorum, man.
Yes.
Next order of business is to approve the agenda.
And we have a, I think John wants to make a motion for adding something else to the agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to add something to new business in regards to the incentive program.
This was an email sent out yesterday.
You want to second me?
I second that.
I know we just met.
Motion is passed, and we will then entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
You have a second? And then we have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to do roll call?
Yeah.
John Fowler?
Yes.
Michelle Dennis?
Yes.
Bob Colby?
I saw a yes.
John Lauk?
Yes.
Bill Pearson?
Yes.
David Patterson?
Yes.
Laura Rohde?
Yes.
Sandvig?
Yes.
Francis Swiper?
Yes.
Hey, Bob, you're on mute. Do you mind taking yourself off so I could get your vote?
For the top. For the top right.
Great. We can't hear.
There you go.
The next order of business then is the approval of the minutes of the previous meeting. We have a comment.
I shall move. Second.
Roll, please.
John Fowler?
Yes.
Michelle Dennis?
Yes.
Bob Colby?
Yes.
John Lauk?
Yes.
Bill Pearson?
Yes.
David Patterson?
Yes.
Yes.
Sandvig?
Yes.
Yes.
The next order of business, our public comments. I'm not aware, but there may be members of the public here who wish to speak, and this is the time. I hear none. Well, we will go to the Street Review Board and miss.
All right.
I will get the slides shared here. All right. So we have one nomination for the State Review Board this morning. It's for Bessida Hall and Sokol Park in Taber. The current owner is Bessida Hall Incorporated. That's a membership organization of the town. And it's being nominated under Criterion A at a statewide level of significance for the areas of social history, performing arts, entertainment, recreation, and ethnic heritage, Czech heritage. The nomination's also marked under criteria consideration A as a religious property, which are typically not eligible for the National Register unless special exceptions are met. And this one, this property was owned by a Catholic organization from 1930 to 2022. But it meets the exceptions because of its significance for the broader history of the town and ethnic heritage. The hall and the park are adjacent to each other and located on the main street in Taber. And you can see Taber marked in relation to some other southeastern cities. I approached the nomination as a traditional cultural property. That's not a particular type or a type of nomination, but it is the way to think about significance and integrity. And we have some noise feedback, so if board members are willing to mute during this section, that might help.
There you go.
Okay. So traditional cultural properties are about the continuation of a traditional practice associated with a particular cultural group. The National Park Service has a bulletin specifically about these types of properties, which typically are associated with indigenous tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations, but can be any identified cultural group. And the bulletin is being rewritten, and actually one of the examples from the draft new bulletin is the Czech Hall in Queens. So I had that to as a parallel reference to work from. That helps when I was thinking about the period of significance. You might have noticed it's from 1918 to the present, and it's unusual for us to take a period of significance to the present, but with traditional cultural properties, that is more the standard because of its continuing role. And with integrity, there still needs to be historic integrity, particularly if the property is a building. But the particular material, even the design, is less important than the relationship of the property to the practice, having the space for those cultural practices and the sort of the structure for the function, rather than as critical as materials might be for significance for architecture, say. So this is the layout of the hall to the park with the grandstand, and then the floor plan layout, how the lobbies entered from the west of the main hall and the additions. And I included the years because that helped me keep it straight as I was writing as well. The space itself, you can see the photos from the lobby on the right and the main hall, which was built as early as 1904, if not earlier, and then went through a major expansion in 1918. So that's what I chose the first date for, and then had some remodels in the 30s and 50s. There are details of there's still two backdrops, painted backdrops from the historic period, and the box where the prompter would have been. And then below are the photos of the annex that was from the 70s and the patio that was added in the 90s. 80s, 90s.
What was that painting of?
Mural.
Or mural.
I
just a city.
Sort of,
the backdrop.
A generic city.
Drama presentations.
Yeah. But most of the plays would have been Czech, so it's sort of based on generic Czech town, probably. Okay.
There's no skyscraper like that in Taber, is there?
No. This is Sokol Park. There have been some new signs and fences, but the green space where the dancing and the festivities and concerts have happened is still there in the landscaping. And then the grandstand is relatively recent, but there has always been sort of a performance space and an audience space in the park. And then the newspapers that Dennis with the Czech Heritage Preservation Society was able to share the microfilms that they had with me, and those were a rich source. He shared other clippings. I was able to use published histories from the State Library here. So I'll move fast, but I wanted to share just some of the wealth of research sources that there was for this property. You can see it started, the first mention of the Wayside Inn I could find there was 1904. And then 1918, the clip that describes how the hall was modified substantially, that they apparently split it in half and pulled it apart and added on. What it looked like historically with the lumberyard next door that would become Sokol Park, selling the barn cupolas there, ventilators. And for a time, the front part of the Michael Hall was a restaurant, and there, the local Heritage Society has some photos of the restaurant and their staff. When the Catholic Lodge, Workman Lodge, bought it in 1930, and they changed the name to Bessida, and the newspaper covered why the name change was there. What it looked like in the 30s with the older front part, and a photo from the first sort of Czech day that I saw called Czech Day, that was also used to raise money to send to Europe for war efforts. And then what's slightly covered on our screen in the room is the Sokol organization that was the gymnastic organization that brought a lot of competitions and practices and all sorts of events to the hall and park. Music, a big part from the earlier bands that when they first started sort of using costumes to promote as Czech bands, and the way that it went through the radio era when they had visiting bands, including this Bohemian Orchestra from a Nebraska city. And it was used by the municipal band that would have rehearsals and concerts in the hall and the park at different times. So many dances got mentioned in the papers, from just commercial dances with visiting bands, ones hosted by the Sokol organization. The newspaper had clips like the one on the lower left about how you should behave at dances and how poor behavior wouldn't be tolerated, and smart Alex take notice, which I found amusing when it was the Opera House, days. It was used for a lot of movies, and those got advertised every week. And the paper, for most of its life, had at least one or two pages in Czech. So there were times when I could find the same information in both. I translated some of the Czech things through with online translation services to see how close they were, for what those are. But I relied on the English when I could find it. And they were usually pretty close. And school carnivals, for many years, the school held many big events in the hall because it was one of the biggest spaces in town. A lot of drama from visiting bohemian groups from Chicago to local Czech plays and Czech plays by towns in the vicinity and from Nebraska. And there are some earlier photos. Those Czech plays started in a different building and then moved to Bessida Hall when it was bought in the 30s. But so there's a photo from an earlier play that was probably in Society Hall.
Is there a way to shrink Colby so we can see the photos?
You can move him around.
Right. We just made an adjustment in the views of the screen in the room here. The newspapers indicated a great interest of the local Czech community with global events. So from the Czech independence and World War I movement, there were visiting speakers and events and fundraising. This one talked about relief efforts just after the war, when visiting speakers came to raise funds to send back to the new Czech Republic. And then around World War II, as in the late 30s, as the fall of Czechoslovakia was coming, there were speakers to talk about that. And then afterwards, this newspaper editor who had been to Tabor previously came back to talk about after it had fallen to Russia and the Soviet Union, what it was like in Czechoslovakia at that point. So there were many speakers that came to town to continue those ties. There are two more from the war. An example of an event held to raise money for the new Czechoslovak army. And then after Nazi Germany destroyed Lidice in Czechoslovakia, Tabor was one of the places that named something for the village and memorial. So there's the announcement in the Tabor paper, and then when they had the event to rename the main street as Lidice, and hopefully that pronunciation is close-ish, Lidice Street, and the big event that they held for that. And then Czech days, of course, has been the most enduring cultural practice, I would probably say, and the biggest draw in terms of outreach to the broader community. But from early days looking at heritage activities, at continuing the music and the dance, and the Beseda folk dance in particular, with costume photos, the one from our state archives in particular to highlight there. And then continuing on, the Czech Heritage Preservation Society formed in the later 20th century, and members continued working on Czech language, on the history of the community, and writing plays. Like Helen showed there, wrote several plays herself for the group to perform in the hall. And the dances have continued as well. So again, this is Beseda Hall in Sokol Park. It's being nominated under Criterion A at a statewide level for representing Czech heritage, as well as the social history, performing arts, and entertainment recreation for the city of Tabor and community around it. And then I think we can let invite Dennis, if he would like to give a statement. He brought us the property proposed for nomination to begin with, if you'd like to, and then we'll open it for board questions.
Before we vote, let's give the representatives from Tabor the opportunity to speak.
Okay. We're very dedicated to preserving a lot of our history. Our Czech Heritage Park, which is just right next to the Sokol Park. We have one building there, the log schoolhouse, which is already on the National Register. And then we're waiting for the park to become qualified as a 50, being there 50 years, because all the buildings were moved in, which will be in the next two or three years. So we plan on being back to nominate that also. And Beseda Hall is the mainstay for our community. It is continually being used predominantly for weddings right now, and the any other cultural events or events from our local organizations rent the hall to for their use also. We had our 150th year celebration of Tabor in the hall, and had representatives, the Czech ambassador from Chicago was there. Our other representatives, our affiliate from Minneapolis and one from Kansas City were also there also. So it's been home for many events like that. A few years ago, we had a huge orchestra that came from the Czech Republic to perform there, and we had to extend the stage to fit everybody out there. And it was just unbelievable that when they were there to perform. So we're very proud of our building. So hope you would consider it for inclusion.
Mr. Chairman, very strong application. Looks like I wish I had been at some dances there back in the day. Would like to make the motion to add it to our list of nominees for the National Registry.
I second that.
Any further discussion? And I have been there for check bits.
If you would like a little anecdote, Freddie Klocek, after having been in the Czech Republic, we'd been there also, and we were talking, and he said that he went over there and he saw people on the street corner, and he started talking Tabor Czech to them, and they looked at him like he was from Mars, because he was speaking Czech as they spoke it about 200 to 300 years ago, and they didn't understand what he was saying, but he could pick up a little bit on his own. So Tabor has been, like a lot of the Hutterite colonies, a reservoir of the old language as it was spoken in the past, and it hasn't progressed or evolved as a lot of the other languages have. They maintain that as a reservoir for looking back at history when people from either the Germany or the Czech Republic come to the United States to find out how the old language was spoken.
Tom Fowler?
Yes.
Michelle Dennis?
Yes.
Bob Colby?
Yes.
John Lau?
Yes.
Bill Pearson?
Yes.
David Patterson?
Yes.
Laura Rohde?
Yes, sorry about that.
Brian Sandberg?
Yes.
Chris Swiper?
Yes.
And we can be in the same review board, and we'll go on in the same review board now, and rest of the program director report.
I'd just like to thank you all very, very much. Appreciate it, and the presentation was great. So
I hope I learned something. They're pretty much on my mind. So thank you.
And we in the Tabor community like to preserve our histories. You know, we've got our church there, our both parish houses. We've got a number of items listed on the National Register. So we'll do our best to continue.
Thank you for all your hard work, Governor.
Thank you.
We will invite you to come back to the function.
That'd be fun. Great.
So, Ben, I think you're the first report.
Yes. The only thing, well, I got a couple of things to add from my written and previously submitted report. One is from the first paragraph there. The governor has appointed a gentleman by the name of Gary Guan to become the South Dakota State Historic Preservation Officer. Gary is currently, or most recently, the lead archaeologist in the preservation office in Hawaii, where that is in Georgia. And he grew up and was raised in China and immigrated to the United States as a graduate student. So he has a very interesting and broad background, a wide variety of things. He's fascinated in indigenous peoples from all over the world. And we're looking forward to this energy and fresh look at a lot of things with the Chippewa. So he will start on the 24th of this month. So he's in the midst of meeting here and we just want to the United States and so forth. What a perfect bonus, I should say, coming on the United States from BYU. So we're glad that Gary will be here and in that meeting is Jack with the Chippewa office. You may have heard through the grapevine, I'm not sure, but Jamie has submitted her resignation and is moving on. So Jamie staffed this process for the last two and a half years or so, has taken a position as a Register of Deeds for Potter County.
So Sheberg.
Yeah. So she's leaving us and getting a really great opportunity for her and reducing her commute by some 15 minutes to share. So
will wind up living much closer to home and where her branch is. And her baby is on the way. So a lot of things to consider. But I'd like to thank Jamie for all her hard work, which will continue until the 20th, when it's her last day. So.
I think that is all I have, unless there's any questions for me. I would say
for those who are in the room, we will provide the opportunity to go up to the Folk Heritage Center and tour the facility after this meeting. You guys can walk through and see what the construction is with the lobby, the new lodge, the offices as they're coming together, and the museum. Although the museum's not much to look at. Okay. Jelly.
You're on mute, Shelly.
I'm here, just trying to get everything to work. Technology, right? I don't really have a whole lot to add. You can see we're very busy with our digitization work. The Doan Robinson collection is just about done. It'll probably be online in the next several months. Archives Month will be celebrated in October. The poster is done. It's going to go on our website. The proclamation has been submitted to the governor's office. We'll have a press release going out in the next couple of weeks. So that'll be the focus for October for us, is promoting not only our archives, but the rest of the archives in the state. The government archivist position that was held by Virginia Hansen was posted in August and is open for another week or so. So hopefully I'll be able to get that filled here shortly. So, otherwise, we are just really busy with trying to get prepared for the move back into the building. So that's it for me. Any questions? Yes.
Cassie, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. The only update I have is that we're continuing to look for a venue for the 2025 History Conference. We're co-hosting with West River and aiming for October 2025. So West River pitched an idea, and we're just not sure if it works, so we're just trying to come up with a few other ideas, but we should hopefully have something pinned down in the next month or so. Otherwise, we had the Jefferson Peace Medal consultation last week, and that'll be discussed more in this meeting. Otherwise, that's it. Are there any questions? Okay.
Go ahead and finish up with the online folks with the.
What was that?
I'm passing off to Dita from the press. Dita, you're on mute.
Finally, okay. Sorry about that. And Ben, I'm glad you repeated, because you cut out at the beginning. I was like, did he say my name? I don't know. Did he say my name? hello, everybody. Good morning. And I don't have much to update on my report as well. We're just about to hit the ground running with all of our conference travel this week, and had a really good almost week at the state fair. It went super well. And we're awaiting the arrival of our last two books, as I mentioned in the report. And this is when it gets nerve-wracking, because we're really close to go to book festivals. I was on the phone with the printers yesterday. And we're very excited to see, especially how the reprint of Giants in the Earth is received. Looking forward to that. So I'm happy to entertain any questions.
I'm glad Vito brought up the fair. We've done a table at the fair along with the press for 3 years now. And every year, I think we've topped over 1,000 conversations we've had with people over the 5-6 days we've been there. So it's been great. First year we were there, people tended not to know who we were. And this year, I didn't get that sense from anybody. I talked to people, are used to seeing us now, kind of part of the seen people will come up and ask, how's the building going? And they kind of seem to know what's going on. So I think between the public service announcements we do on the radio that we can do as a government agency with no charge, and the other outreach we've been doing in the prayer and so forth, it seems to be paying off. So.
Okay. I just saw your book festival posters in Brookings, so you're getting some good publicity.
Thank you. Nice to hear that.
There's no other questions. David, why don't you go ahead?
Good morning, everybody. My name is David Gravitsky. I'm the museum director. You've got the report in front of you, so I won't read it. As you can see, it was an exceptionally busy period. A couple of updates to the report. The effigy that the trustees concurred in loaning has gone to the Crystal Bridges Museum in Arkansas. And the opening for donors was last night, and the opening for the public is tomorrow. So it will run until January 27th. And the Crystal Bridges folks said that any board members that are able to come, to please let them know. And they would like to give you a tour of the exhibit. And related to that is an update on scanning. After a bit of exploring, we're finally able to talk to Rebecca Hasse on August 19th and agreed to scan after the effigy returns to the society. It will be scanned vertically, and they are right now working on a quote for you. And then lastly, I want to say a measure of personal thanks to all of you for helping develop the active collection list. And to note that later today, we hope to accept a donation of Jamie Damon dress. And she was a 9-year-old girl who had a 4th grade assignment. And her assignment was to write to Jacqueline Kennedy. And in it, she happened to include the invitation to come visit the dam my daddy is building. And so it's widely credited as the reason why Kennedy came and dedicated the Owyhee Dam. So we hope to take possession of that dress this afternoon. Thank you. If there's any other questions, feel free.
Question. You mentioned the Collection Management Committee and the criteria we discussed last time. Who's on the Collection Management Committee?
The Collection Management Committee is composed, I have to chair that, and then it's also composed of Renette Rumsa, Dan Muckley, Katie Schmidt, Corey Christensen, and Britta Brisfin.
And these are all employees of the
correct
society.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I had, you opened your report with the kits that are going out to schools.
Yeah.
What grades are they addressed to?
They're specifically tailored for the 4th grade, but they can be used in any grade. And then they are multidisciplinary, so although they're founded on history, they can be used for math or science or reading, a variety of subjects.
Is there any movement to advance those to high school? I mean, make kits.
Those kits can be used in high school. Yeah.
And
in fact, over the summer, probably our biggest renter during the summertime are libraries, and it's very much geared toward an adult audience.
Other criteria that you've been working on?
The South Dakota history is kind of spread across K-12, particularly grade 5 through high school. You could see kind of a natural progression for students to want to get better at their course.
Question for the about the collection committee. Is there a resume that we might see on what their background is? I mean, I've often said, you know, you don't get a cattle auctioneer to sell used cars, and it would be nice to know what some of the historic background and that the collection committee has.
Yeah, those can be provided. Sure. The move is tentatively planned. So there are two moves, and sometimes they quite naturally are confused. The first move is of the people, and the second move is of the collection. And those two are separate. And on October 8th, we hope to move the people back to the Cultural Heritage Center. And then following that, we'll move the collection as soon as that's ready.
I put in the report some water issues with the city and the buildings. First, we slid it to the 8th.
I drove by there on the way to 800 Governors Avenue today, and it didn't look quite ready to move in.
Well, outside, the exterior appearance may continue up until they fall.
Right. They will be in the process of, they are pouring sidewalks right now, and all of the sod will be laid and reseeded in the coming weeks.
And here, just because I saw that you. Can you see yourself? Catherine Forsch with the South Dakota Historical Society Foundation. And new for my report is I'd like to introduce you to Amanda Van Valen. Amanda is taking over as our Director of Finance. Director recently resigned. She had been there 8 years, and we're very fortunate to have Amanda on board, and I'm going to let her give just a short, brief intro on her background. And
yeah. Let me interrupt just a moment. Without speaking into the mic, can the people out there hear it?
Yeah, there's mics in the ceiling. Okay. So
can you hear all right on the, those online?
Yes.
I'm Amanda. I'm born and raised in Pierre Fort Pierre area. Went to school mines for a few years, transferred to USD criminal justice major, and then I went back to school after I had kids, got my information systems degree. So I used to work for electric utility companies. I was the executive assistant for electric utility companies under Bob Miller. So a lot of the financial history comes from that job, as well as I was a finance analyst for the Department of Heating Services. So I bring that, as long as a strong IT background, which you kind of need to work those numbers. So
we're enjoying the strong IT background because a lot of things aren't going, having to go through bit. It's like, Amanda, how do we get this to work? So we're excited. We're also moving to a new membership and donor platform. And because of that, Amanda will be able to help us navigate through that. We'll have tons of reports to set up and going to be using her expertise there. the foundation's going to be moving to a new website this, hopefully before the end of the year. And Amanda's specialty is also in web development. So we've got a lot of things going on. I just wanted to add a note to Shelley's report on the Doan Robinson collection. One of the reasons that we're able to digitize that collection is because we had a donor that stepped up and supported it. So thank you to all those that may be online and listening in. We appreciate your support and are able to do that.
Is that Doan Robinson's correspondence and everything, or what exactly was digitized?
Boxes and boxes of his records. So correspondence, letters about Mount Rushmore, all the telegrams back and forth between him and Borglum, letters with General Beadle, just a wide variety of documentation that really highlights all of that, how active he was, and the speeches he gave, the text of those comments, and so forth.
Is there enough there for a biography, would you say?
Perhaps, yes.
Why he's called Doan Robinson?
Yes.
A lot of fun things.
Yeah.
Any questions?
On the oral history thing, I haven't seen a list of all the people that you've interviewed. Have you interviewed Ted Munster?
Ted Munster, he was on our list, wasn't he?
I don't think,
but I don't think we've interviewed him.
USD has. So we've been working with USD Oral History Center, not the people paid interviews.
So we have been putting all of our potential candidates into a spreadsheet, and USD has access to the individuals that we are interviewing, and we have access to the individuals they're interviewing, so we're trying not to overlap. But he is in that list.
Is the subject matter the same? I mean, their approach may have been significantly different from ours.
Yeah, it could. We would have talked to Ted about politics of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and so I have not heard his interview at this time, but I'm sure USD would share that with us. That was the plan with this work. And John,
the USD one done.
Three years ago.
3 5 years ago.
Oh,
yeah.
Fairly recent.
And John, thank you for participating. And John and Tony Benhuizen did a recap of politics of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, so we can pull this whole project together. Appreciate you doing that.
I think it'd make a good book in the end, like all these 70s and 80s stories, like modern South Dakota politics. So
there are some great stories in there.
Yeah. Someday, maybe.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Francis was interviewed as well.
Yes.
But David Floyd interviewed Francis.
Can you speak up a little louder? My battery's wearing down.
I said you were interviewed too as a part of the project since David Plute interviewed you.
And I can provide a full list of those that we interviewed. It's a nice long list.
Yeah, I'd like to see that too.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's it.
That's
okay. That
one from the preservation
team. Preservation office.
I can only the briefest of updates. The other two archaeological burial mound sites were listed, and we've continued to get copies of reports from our contracts, so those are all closing out. But otherwise, if there are questions, we're looking forward to having Gary here and then having him hire the next person so we can be fully staffed and have our feet under us once they're all caught up to speed.
He's moving here from Hawaii just in time for winter. Is that what?
But I asked him about that, and he said, I grew up in northern China. I'm North of Canada. So he's not afraid. Yeah, we'll be looking forward to getting him here, and then the December meeting will be the budget presentation. And
budget grants.
It'll be a big one.
Yeah, it'll be a big one.
Thank you very much, Liz. We're going into other, well, I guess, museum, the accessions should come first.
So,
good morning. We have two items for your consideration for deaccession today. The first is a set of Catholic vestments taken from a Manila church in the wake of the Battle of the Philippine War in 1898-1899. Museum records indicate it was donated by a soldier of that unit in the early 20th century to the State Historical Society in the museum. In preparing for the move, Corey Christensen, a lot of the curators, along with David, literally audited every item in the museum's collection, and as a part of that process, and then as a part of Corey's process in establishing a better collection about a lot of the Philippine items that we have in the museum. We have a surprising amount of cultural items, musical instruments, as well as, well, a wide variety of things that these soldiers brought back in 1899 from their service in the Philippines. But this particular artifact was demonstrated that we suspected it had it's a vestments worn by a priest or a bishop, and was pinned back to the Catholic Basilica Church in Manila, which during the fighting became a place where they would bring the wounded. The vestments have human blood on them that's been tested to show that. So for that reason, we would never exhibit them, and we've been in contact over the past few months with the Catholic diocese in Sioux Falls. They've agreed to take them. And so we would ask this morning your consideration to deassess those items from the collection.
So moved.
Well, we're going
to have a discussion.
Oh, yes. We're going to have the second item, well, and we can do this. We were planning on doing this with one vote for the two items. If you want to do it, a vote per each, but how you want to manage that. But the second item is the Jefferson Peace Medal. This artifact, yes.
Is the diocese in Sioux Falls going to give this back to the Philippines, or has there been any discussion about it?
We're not sure, and I don't know that they're sure exactly what they will intend to do with it. In discussions with the Catholic officials in the area, they had described that they would do a ceremony and dispose of burn the items as a part of a ceremony. Yes. So I'm not sure if that's what they're going to do, but that was an option they were considering. The second item is the Jefferson Peace Medal. This artifact has been on display in the main museum for nearly 20 years. Based on the information available from both the museum donor records, field notes, historical accounts, and oral tradition, we now know that this Jefferson Peace Medal was removed from its burial context in the Sanish or Ricara Grand River villages on or about October 1st of 1935. The medal was removed by a teenager while he was exploring along the Missouri River in Corson County. The medal in question is reasonably believed to have been presented to the Ricara chief, Lightning Crow, in 1804 by Lewis and Clark. Upon their return to the village in 1806, the medal had been transferred to another Arikara chief by the name of Gray Eyes. According to oral tradition, eyewitness accounts, and historical records, Gray Eyes died within the village during an attack by the United States Army in 1823. This was an action during which now is referred to as the Arikara War, where the U.S. and the Lakota fought against the Arikara. Chief Gray Eyes was known to have the medal in his possession at about the time of his death, which would have occurred in early August of 1823. When the U.S. took possession of the villages in August of 1893, they found 31 graves. After the villages were abandoned in 1833, 10 years later, due to a crop failure, disease, and so forth, the double village site has been the subject of many archaeological and historical investigations. The site was well known as a historic Arikara village and was subject to excavation by avocational archaeologists and professionals all across the years. So in about, well, in October of 1935, with this local teenager and friends visited the site and partially excavated a grave that contained the Jefferson Peace Medal. According to the notes from his diaries, we have a quote, Jefferson Medal copper band found at the site along the Double Reed Village, or otherwise known, commonly often referred to as the Leavenworth site. A drawing of the medal was also accompanied in the notes. His notes include a map denoting how far away he was from Wakpala, where the river was, and his approximate location of the grave. The medal was retained by the family until its donation to the Historical Society in 2004. In 2024, while discussing another matter with the three affiliated tribes, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, this issue was brought up. So I began a thorough review, which included contacting the donor family 20 years after they donated the medal to the society. After several weeks, they sent materials and diaries that demonstrate the Jefferson Peace Medal was taken from the grave. Therefore, the museum staff, the archaeological staff, and myself realized we must repatriate the medal. Indeed, both state and federal law require it. Consultation for the return of the item has begun and will continue in the coming weeks. It's worth noting that the family that donated the item, which is specifically the nephew of the teenager who found the artifact in 1935, supports the repatriation to the tribe. They also ask, out of respect for the fact that the teenager was a minor and was later killed in the Second World War, that his name not be affiliated in the public comments today. Both the vestments and the peace medal have gone through a thorough review and quite lengthy. And along the way, I've kept President Hurlburt, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, but informed in the matter. And as many of you may recall, we discussed this at the last meeting in July. So I'll stand by for questions. We have folks from the Archaeological Research Center online, as well as the museum curator and staff also in the room. But I would urge your yes vote to the deaccession of both the vestments and the Jefferson Peace Medal.
To rephrase the motion, John, to include both items?
Sure.
Second?
I guess I have a little problem with the robe. We don't know what's going to happen to it if we deaccession it.
Well, that's in some regards, what happens to either one of the items is I appreciate the question, and that's why we've been working with them to be able to answer that. I guess I would grant some respect to Catholic diocese to sort that out at their own pace and their own time. They've been aware of this for several
years. If they destroy it, it doesn't get back to Manila. I mean,
well,
we have attempted to contact the church in Manila, and that's proved fruitless. So the South Dakota diocese is kind of the backup. We've even reached out to the Vatican, and that's produced no response. So.
You've done it as much as you could.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, there's no reason we couldn't express the hope that they will complete the communication to the Philippines.
Yes.
Yeah. We certainly can continue that.
I share your view that destruction is not the answer to school. We've had a motion and a second.
We got some discussion on
that. David was. I'm sorry.
A note that as Catholic vestments are considered sacred items, and especially considering the fact that there is human blood on it, it would be entirely appropriate within Catholic tradition that they be appropriately deconsecrated and cremated. That is standard practice and has been for centuries.
Thanks, Dave. Any other comments?
A question.
This is Laura. I'd just like to say thank you for all the steps that you've taken on both these items to make sure that they, you know, the best happens to them, because, you know, people are humans and evidently didn't understand the danger that they, you know, taking something from a grave is not appropriate. After what David has said, you know, we know that the appropriate steps the diocese can handle. So I just appreciate you doing your homework and being the experts that you are in ensuring that these items return to the way they're supposed to be. So thank you.
Question? That would be, is that the peace medal, does that go back to an individual? Does that go back to the tribe? Who is the recipient when it's repatriated?
We are in consultation with the tribe, and they are attempting to find the descendant of the gentleman who was in the grave with the medal. As of this moment, as of last Friday, they've been unsuccessful. So it may go to the tribe if they can't find an individual descendant. In fact, it could probably remain with the tribe, some kind of capacity.
Thank you.
There are no further comments. We've had a motion. Second. Francis.
No, in regard to this rug going to the Philippines, we should just return it. And if they want to burn it, whatever tradition they have, it's there. They do it, not here.
No.
That's going.
All right, once more, no further comments. We'll take a roll call on the motion.
John Fowler?
Yes.
Michelle Dennis?
Yes.
David Gretler?
Aye.
Bob Colby?
Yes.
John Lauk?
Aye.
Bill Pearson?
Yes.
David Patterson?
Yes.
Laura Rohde?
Yes.
Brian Sandvig?
Yes.
Francis Weiber. Yes. And you move on to other business.
You can go ahead.
And we added one item to the agenda, and that might be appropriate to take up first.
So in your, you pass that down. You were emailed copies of a motion yesterday by Jamie. To be in your inbox. This is an incentive to membership program that we thought of just last week after noting another
organization that has been doing this in order to grow members and subscribers and so forth.
We know that our best membership growth is for current members to ask friends or to talk about us to their friends that they think might be interested in South Coast history. So out of an idea to facilitate that, we thought of a gift program and
came up with these revised rates that a current member could give a gift to a prospective member, somebody who's never been a member, at these lower rates for 1 year, and then that member would renew, or the gift might be renewed at the regular rate.
That's the hope, that obviously that they like what they get with the four journals and early membership benefits, and that they would be in a year from now. There's a bit of a rush because we'd like to do this for Christmas as a part of the gift giving that goes on with the holidays. And so that's why we wanted to vote on it at this meeting. Administrative Rule 2552.05.01, to sound very bureaucratic, is the guidance that gives the trustees the option to exercise various incentive programs and to modify the rates, which are in rule. Mr. C below me there. On the paper, the current rates, you can see individuals are 50, students are 30, and so on down. So open up for comments or questions.
I want to do it this time.
I so moved.
Second.
I have a little discussion with this, and I've received a lot of similar promotions in the recent past, and it hasn't come as a option to have a reduced rate in your gift, but more a free gift to a member who renews at the regular rate. And my concern is that if you're really going to get a great benefit from this, it's much more of an incentive to give if it's a free gift to the rather than a reduced rate. But I realize that we're in a little different position from these commercial entities that from which I've received similar offers. We can reconsider whether at a later date, depending on the reaction to this offer, whether we want to make it free and look into the implications of that. So I'm not recommending we change the motion at this time.
Okay. At the September meeting next year, we'd be in a position, hopefully, to tell you how many gifts were given, at what rates. We won't know renewal rates yet, but we would be positive. So if we need to tweak what we've done this year to change it for next year, we'd like to do that. But this is kind of, just like you said, it's
an experiment. Yeah.
Call the question, Mr. Chairman.
If there are no further comments, we can have the roll call.
John Fowler?
Yes.
Michelle Dennis?
Yes.
David Gretler?
Austin.
Bob Colby? You're on mute, Bob.
Take that as a yes. Give it a go.
Okay, there you go.
John Lowe.
Hi.
Bill Pearson.
Yes.
David Patterson.
Yes.
Laura Rohde.
Yes.
Ryan Sandvig.
Yes.
Francis Weiberg.
Yes.
Motion's passed. Go on to the next item, which is the history conference update for next year.
Yeah. Well, Cassie kind of covered that in her report. We continue to work with West River on a venue. We're mindful of, we hope to get a large crowd. And so we're really in the Deadwood area. That's where West River is pointing toward. So we're working on that. We have ADA compliance issues and parking, and there's more to it than I think when we merge the group in size and numbers and so forth, better consideration. So we're continuing to work. Okay. So
hopefully the lodge and Deadwood Mountain Grand will have the parking and ADA.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're probably booked.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I'd love to continue to work with Kevin. Kevin, years. He's about that.
What's the theme?
We're not prepared to announce it yet, but we wanted to do something along the lines of history's mysteries. Very broad, and thinking about questions in the past that have been unanswered, and have people do presentations on mysteries of history or something like that, and then have some fun with that. But that may not be the final version.
Yeah, I've been to a bunch of these history conferences, and I find out that
there's not much. Categories, as it were, on Indian history.
Yeah.
As a result, Indian people come. If you throw in something of interest of Indian people, I'm sure it will generate some interest. But
yeah.
You look at that and they say, just another white patient. Father.
Well, if you can help spread the word once we have things kind of sorted out, and once we have location, dates, venues, and so forth, the historical societies know recruits its speakers. So we try to.
I think we've been pretty successful over the past few years recruiting a wide variety, including American speakers to come and present a wide variety of things, and so we maybe put some targeted word of mouth and advertising. In different communities, we can overcome that.
You know, I could insist on speakers. I know Indian country is like nobody's.
I'm not sure you can. Great.
What is the date of the history conference?
Well, we're shooting for early October. Early October. That's generally when the West River is met. We're keeping with that.
We still tie it in with board meeting?
No.
Well, and that, yeah.
September now.
If you want to, there may not be a compelling reason to actually leave it on September 12th. You could probably slide it a couple of weeks and have a meeting just before the conference.
Whoever would like to do that, get there.
Do we not used to have the conference in the spring?
Yes, we've always had the conference in the spring and tied it to that spring meeting and the awards banquet. So
this conversation with West River and with Augie that will ensue the following year has been a series of trade-offs. The awards banquet, which we would do as a part of our conference, we may stick to that and do that in April anyway. The awards that you hand out in so that they don't get too stale from the previous year. We have to tweak that. So then the following, 2 years later, when we plan on teaming up with Center for Western Studies at Augustana, their conference is in April. So it winds up with January. In fact, we often overlapped on the same weekend.
A couple times we conflicted.
Yeah, which was the problem. Which led to hopefully we can merge.
Okay, then we move on, unless somebody has some further comments, to the meeting schedule for next year. I would open the discussion there with the notation that Giants in the Earth, which we're publishing this fall, and then on April 26th and 27th of next year, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra is going to put on the opera based on the book. Do we want to consider, you got an April 11th there. Do we want to consider anything closer to the opera? Is there any connection? Is there any synergy between the two?
With that, you guys will also need to consider where you're hosting your meeting. So if that's the case, you'll be hosting your meeting in Sioux Falls in April and then back in Deadwood in October if you change that September meeting to an October meeting. So just keep those into consideration as well, where you're hosting and budgeting.
I'll admit that I'm thinking of my personal travel, but
yeah. Well, I mean,
there could be some connection.
We have, it's been a lot, a lot of the trustees have communicated to me a desire to move these meetings around the state.
No, I agree with that.
So we have the last meeting in the city. Why don't we do this? I'd encourage the trustees to think about how there might be a tie with the April meeting with the opera. I can look for a venue for the meeting in Sioux Falls. And then if we, in the December meeting, we could adjust the schedule as people want to do that and discuss and make a motion for that.
Yeah, I just think the meeting might be an attraction for more people. I mean, you know, part of the support
for the HARPA.
HARPA.
In fact, the orchestra has a very nice company. Maybe you could talk to Dave
in the pavilion.
Talk about borrowing this very nice.
John, we won't rely on John to buy his house or anything.
No, but maybe it's back here.
Well, the next, if there's any questions before we adjourn this meeting, anyone has?
I'd apologize for my being so quiet, but I have a screen separation on my laptop, and I had a new shoulder put in a couple months ago, and the manipulations are a little tough, but I'm pleased to hear all things going as well as they are. But I do have some questions that I will try to communicate with each of you at some time in the near future. Thank you.
Next meeting is scheduled for December 13th, and the next action item is possible adjournment. Do I have any motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, roll call.
Tom Ballard?
Yes.
Michelle Dennis?
Yes.
David Rettler? Bob Colby?
Yes.
John Lauck? Bill Pearson?
Yes.
David Patterson?
Yes.
Laura Rudy?
Yes.
Brian Zandig? Francis Whiteford?
Yes.
Meeting's adjourned.